Coach, welcome into the hours. Really appreciate you listening if you're on audio only and if you're watching on YouTube. Love that you're here with us and that you're finding value in the podcast. I wanted to set this podcast up because it's a little different. So the previous episode, The Savvy Method, the recording that you're about to hear was part of the previous episode. So we went through The Savvy Method, and then Tyler and I played a little game where I asked him a bunch of quick hitting questions, which is what this episode is going to be. After recording, Tyler and I decided to split this into two because it was a longer episode. And we felt like there was a lot of really good content in here that we wanted to make sure that you got. So if you haven't listened to the previous episode, I would advise you to go back. We talk a little NBA Summer League and the differences between college pro, but more importantly, Tyler dives into what the Savvy Method is and how he applies that to coaching and leadership. And then the game follows, which again is going to be in this podcast. So if you listen to the previous one, you'll enjoy this game. If you didn't listen to the Savvy Method episode, go back, listen to that one, and then come back and check this one out. You know, we started working together, I don't know, a year and a half ago. I don't even know how long
ago. It's only been a year and a half. It feels like much longer.
I don't know. Like, could be 10 years. I don't know. But one thing that was just really evident is, then it's an important lesson for coaches, is like, are your values like really core values to you? You know, and it's obvious that simplicity, diversity, victory, and identity are core to you. And it's how we run the business side of Savvy. It's obviously the Savvy Method, which you just went through, how we help coaches have their best season yet and transform the way they coach and teach and the way their teams play the game. But like very, very early on in our partnership, I could see like, oh, okay, this guy doesn't just talk about it. Like, he really lives these values. And I would challenge every coach, especially right now, if you're listening, you know, shortly after this podcast came out, it's July, it's the off season. Like, what, you know, don't come up with like core values for your team. Come up with core values that you really believe in, and then your team will embody those, because that's what you're naturally going to bring every day. And that's what Tyler brings to Savvy every single day. So that was incredible. Loved it. all right. Let's play a game here. We're going to play a quick game. And for those listening, Tyler has not, he has no idea this is coming. Okay. But so I'm going to explain the game to Tyler and to you. So Tyler has zero prep. We'll put him on the spot here. He'll be on the hot seat, and we'll see if these values are really core to him or not.
Yes.
All right. So we're going to work on our 7-second game. You got 7 seconds or less to give me an answer here. One word, two words, or maybe a sentence will do. And I'll give you the chance, if there's something that's like you just really want to expand on, after each section, you'll have a chance to like expand or go deeper or frame whatever your answer was. And I might have a follow-up too, based on your answer. All right. So I'm going to break these questions down into 4 categories. You might be able to guess them: simplicity, of this adversity, victory, and identity. All right. So 7 seconds or less. Here's why we're doing like quick ones. Cause I want it to be, one, spontaneous, but two, like, how clear is your thinking? If you can't communicate something to your players in 7 seconds or less, you haven't thought it through, right? Or if you can't explain it to a 5-year-old, then you don't understand it quite enough yourself. There's some work that you've got to do to clarify, which every coach should be doing in the offseason. All right. Any questions before we get started?
No question, one comment. I think this would be a good exercise for anyone listening to this podcast to like see what your answer would be. You could even, after Mark asks it, just press pause and like attempt to verbalize it. That would be doing the work, you know, and you know, then you could listen to mine and use it or don't use it as well. But I mean, this is an exercise for every one of you listening as well.
Yeah. And I'll say this, if you press pause and your answer is different than Tyler's, that's okay. It does not mean you're not a savvy coach, or it doesn't mean that one is right and one is wrong. Tyler and I will probably have different answers to these questions as well. But I think that's the beauty of doing this podcast. We get to talk basketball and see how much we agree on, disagree on, and there's no right or wrong. All right. So given that there's no right or wrong answer, these are questions around simplicity. All right. Are you ready? Are you nervous? A little nervous? Okay. All right. Here we go. Question number one, one word that defines your offensive identity.
Race.
I love it. Okay. Go to principle under pressure.
2-on-you pass, 1-on-you beat 'em.
Love it. Best teaching tool that you use.
5-on-5.
Did not expect that answer. What's one thing that every coach overcomplicates?
Shooting.
Okay. Okay. That's my four questions around simplicity. Anything you want to expand on?
I would love for you to answer all four of those questions.
All right. One word that defines my offensive identity, I would say pace. Go-to principle under pressure would be space. Best coaching tool that I use would probably be recreate or leading with questions. Gosh, that's a tough one. One thing every coach overcomplicates, I would say roles. Mm. All right.
Agreed. I do want to expand on the shooting one for...
Yeah, you expand on one and then maybe I'll expand on another one.
Rob Fodor, shooting coach with the Miami Heat for a long time. He and I have just geeked out when we've been around each other on shooting. And he has probably, of all the shooting coaches I've ever been around, the most complex study of shooting that I've ever heard. As he went through all the things that he did, he studied how cats move when he was putting together his shooting philosophy. Yeah, exactly.
What?
Yes.
Let me guess, they're like really fluid or something?
No, like he said, like when they're falling, like, you know, cats always land on their feet. Like when they're falling, how they actually land on their feet and land so light. Because he has this theory that the best shooters were just so light on their feet, both when they took off and when they landed. So he was like, okay, so how do the cats actually do that? And then how can you transfer it to shooting? So things that we've never thought about, right? Ballet was another one. So anyway, at the end of all that, all this complexity, he distilled it down to this absolute simplicity. So when he says this, most coaches would be like, no, that's too simple. You can't, that's not shooting. But like, he's gone way more complex than any other coach that still teaches complex. And he says, shooting is simply this, and it rhymes, pass it to the basket, pass it to the basket. Right. He's like, you go right now and you throw any athlete, any player, any coach, right? You go and throw them a cup, or you throw them a golf ball or a ping pong ball, right? They're gonna be able to throw it back to you, and they're not thinking about their form or their technique. They're just seeing with their eyes their target, and they're passing that ball to the target. He's like, that's all shooting is, pass it to the basket, right? Your brain immediately takes into context all the things. Is there a person in the way? Do you have to throw it over or around them? You don't think about the technique that your body uses to do that. You don't calculate, okay, this is 20 steps away, so I need to go 20 degrees. No, you just get the ball, get the object to the target. That's all shooting is. Allow your brain to do what your brain does. It's a problem-solving machine. Pass it to the basket.
I had the opportunity to meet Don Meyer back in the day. And I had the courage to ask him a question. I was a really young coach. My voice was probably quivering a little bit, you know? And I said, Coach, can you tell me how you teach shooting? Cause I think, again, this is something that coaches overcomplicate. I was looking for simplicity here, and he started the answer and I thought he was being sarcastic. And then I had to realize like, oh no, it's just this simple. So the way he taught shooting was four things. Let's see if I remember them. Number one, keep it straight. Number two, aim for the back half because most shots are missed short. But when he said keep it straight, I'm like, okay, he's being sarcastic. Like, you know, but it is that simple. Keep it straight, aim for the back half. That's a positive way to frame, don't miss short. Get it up, right? Like have the right amount of arc so it's falling in the basket. We're not shooting it at the basket. And then he said frame it, hold your follow through. So that was the four things, but yeah, so I would agree.
None of those are like outcome constraints. None of those things are necessarily like technical pieces, right? So like, right. It's an intent.
That's why I thought he was being sarcastic at first, because I was expecting a technical answer. Like, well, we teach our players to, you know, stand like this or hold the ball like this, kind of like the four L's, or the old school, you know, beef.
Yeah. I love it. I think that's awesome. And, you know, if anyone has gone through our shooting system, that's really a similar approach that we use with our tune-ups. Our tune-ups are, can you make the ball do this you know, from this sort of a constraint. You have to rock first. You have to blast the ball off the ground first. Can you make the ball do it? And if you can, like, the ball doesn't lie in shooting. Like, if the ball is not spinning, then you haven't applied force down the center line of the basketball. It's just, that's it, right? If the ball's not, and so, like, there's so many different things. It's just, like, make the ball go straight, and that will straighten up your delivery system.
This reminds me of a topic that came up on one of our live trainings. So as a member of Savvy, so if you're listening to the podcast, you want to go deeper, become a member. You get access to all of our resources. But if you want to go even deeper than just, you know, being a member and having access to the classroom and the community, you can get on weekly live trainings with the Savvy team. And we were on one a couple weeks ago, and shooting came up, and you talked about power, accuracy, and speed. Like, accuracy and speed don't matter if we can't generate power to get it to the basket, right? So, like, don't overcomplicate it. If your players can't generate power efficiently, then we don't really have to worry about making shots yet, because we can't even get the ball there. And if we can't get the ball there, or we can't shoot accurately, then we don't need to worry about getting our shot off faster. And that's always, it was such a good way to articulate that, because for me, I think at the high school level, you probably need most of your players to just have power and accuracy. Because if you're shooting sevens, you don't necessarily need speed. And what's always bothered me, but I didn't know the way to articulate it until I was on that live training with you, is, like, if we're not coming off of a screen to get a shot, or coming off of a zoom to get a shot, then we don't necessarily need the speed. It always bothered me when players were like, I got to get my shot off faster. I'm like, dude, you're a 30% free throw, 3-point shooter. If you shoot faster, you're going to be like a 20% 3-point shooter, right? Like, let's work on the accuracy.
Actually, part. I don't want you to get the shot off faster. I actually want you to maybe shoot a couple less shots.
You're right. Shoot less. Shoot the obvious wide open ones. But those are what sevens are, you know, like wide open catch and shoot. So the game has changed to catch and shoot threes because of drive and kick and space, rather than come off this action and get a shot. There's a place for that, but I just think it's less important. We spent, like, very little time on that in practice, because we were mainly creating advantage and shooting threes because we had the advantage already.
What percent of threes taken, let's do it at three levels, high school, college, and pro. What percent of threes taken at the high school level come off of a screen where a player is, like, on the move, catching and shooting, JJ Redick's living?
Okay, is the question should be off that, or let's say currently are? Yeesh, I'm going to say like 40-ish percent, and I think that's too much.
Okay. That's good. You might have a better gauge on, like, high school basketball. So I'm in this club AAU world, and I've coached hundreds of games. And I'm going to say in that world, 5% are off of, like,
really?
That's good stuff. Yeah, it's very interesting, like 5%. Because I think most club AU offenses are much less structured and they run less stuff.
Yeah.
I agree, 40% is way too much if that is the case. And gosh, would love to help them out. I mean, they're just lower percentage shots. They're lower percentage shots than a standstill driving kick wide open off the catch three.
Yeah, I try to have, like, some kind of self-awareness sometimes. And I know, like, coming off of a screen, like, I don't want those shots. Like, I'm not comfortable taking them. I never have been. I can't get that shot off. Like, I never, power, accuracy, speed, I never really got to the speed thing. Like, I've got to be set. I want a shrink three. I want a paint touch three for me. Otherwise, like, I don't even care about it. And I guess that it's the coaching bias we all have. Like, coaches will ask me, hey, have you ever incorporated staggers into driving space? And I'm like, no, like, I don't want my players shooting off a stagger. Does that mean a stagger is bad? Absolutely not. If you're a coach that loves stagger, I don't say it to offend you. I just don't want my players shooting that. Like, why would I get them in that action?
I'll say this, and I hope this doesn't offend the coach that loves staggers. If you're a coach that loves staggers and put staggers in because you love it, you're doing it for the wrong reason. If you're a coach that has a player that's incredibly effective shooting off of staggered screen, then that's a reason to put it in. You know, like, I'll ask this. So, Mark, on the whole right now, basketball players, would most basketball players shoot a higher percentage on a five, a somewhat contested shot coming off of a run and a stagger, or off of a created three, off of some sort of a dribble move, step back, crossover, hezzy pull, whatever. What do you think they would shoot a higher percentage on?
Are both of them like fives, or is the step back wide open?
I'm going to say both of them have a similar level of contest. I've got a theory on it. I think I could prove it.
I think I would probably say off the bounce, because like shoulders are still square to the basket. You probably know you're open a little bit earlier than when you're coming off a screen and then have to catch, square your shoulders, mm-hmm. and then read defense and shoot that one. What do you think?
I'm going to go way stronger on off the bounce. And for this reason, not a technical reason, it's what most players practice more. Hmm. When players are out there doing their skill work and, you know, getting after it, they're doing everything off the bounce. Hardly anyone is out there working on shooting off the move on their own. Hardly anyone. No trainers out, like it's super rare. Then you look at the highest levels. How are these fives generated? How does Luka generate them? He's not coming off screens, off the bounce. Shea, every star player is generating their threes off the bounce. Steph, right? Steph probably is the one that might receive like a give up, sprint back and get it back shot more than anybody else, but he's still generating the majority of his off the bounce. I mean, name the players in the NBA that are generating them off the catch. Clay, Desmond Bane a little bit.
It'd be like your Duncan Robinsons.
Right?
Kyle Korver, you know.
Yeah, but like they're the minority, right? So it just goes to how players practice now. So that's another reason why I would just kind of do away with it, because it's not, players aren't training it. Players are training how they can create their own three. Hey everybody, this is Tyler, and I'd like to personally invite you to join our free savvy coaching community. Post any question you have here in our chat and get your questions answered, as well as get access to all of our free resources in our savvy community. We've got it all here for you. So click the link below and we'll see you inside.
Okay. Let's go through college and pro then. You answer this one for me. How many are generated catch and shoot off an action? College.
I don't know. I don't watch college basketball, but I'm assuming less than high school. I don't know. I feel like, yeah, that's my assumption. You would know better than me.
Yeah, I don't know. I was going to say more okay. as you go up in level, but
because you said 40% of all threes taken.
Yeah, you know, and I don't love that number. I'm just trying to think of like how it all depends on your system, you know. Yeah. I think a lot of high school coaches are still coaching traditionally. So they're running a lot of stuff. I know, I mean, even coaches that we consult for, I mean, I mean, again, that's why I brought up the stagger thing or like some kind of pin down or these actions. And I'm just like, I mean, I don't know, coach. We're just trying to get Tudo on the ball. Like, that's it. Like, that's all I care about is can we just get defense in the coverage? And then you're probably getting a catch and shoot three somewhere else. To me, if you're running that kind of action, just think of it in terms of advantage and not can we create a shot off of this? Because it's just like the ball screen. Who's the benefactor of most ball screens? The three players not involved in the ball screen. So take that same approach to off-ball actions as well.
Yeah, my take on college would just be less than high school. Your take is more, maybe.
NBA, I was going to say the most. I don't know what the number is. Maybe half, maybe more than half, because you got to run more stuff. I mean, but I don't know. But it's such a hard question.
We could get these numbers. And anyone listening, I would love for you to get these numbers. I would argue that the majority of threes taken by volume across the board in the NBA are what I would call kick-out threes. Kick-out or drive kick swing threes. I don't think the majority are players coming off of the move, off of a screen and shooting it.
Yeah, you're right. If you think of an NBA possession, it's just a lot of drive, kick, swing, drive, kick, swing, and you're getting
that initial drive either came off of transition, ball screen, or ISO.
Yeah.
That's how it happened.
Yeah.
Or maybe some sort of like DHO or something like that, or a kick out from a post up double team, which would fall under the ISO piece. Okay, good. I'm glad we solved that. So what's your takeaway, coaches? Consider leaning into what most players are training and what most players are best at, and consider eliminating, you know, scripting, you know, screen threes. I mean, if you need a three at the end of the game, you have to get a three up. How are you generating it?
It's probably going to be one of those shots that we talked about. It's probably going to be the off the bounce. Yeah.
Right.
Let's go through adversity questions, and then we'll do a little follow-up, expand on, but it probably won't be as long as that one. That was really good, though. All right, adversity questions. Messiest but most effective activity in practice, and for coaches, activity would be like a drill or a game. All right, so messiest but most effective activity that you use in practice.
I'm going to go disadvantage game. So a disadvantage game is where let's say you're working on offense. You actually put the offense at a disadvantage. We did it last night. We did 2v3 ball screen. I know I only have 7 seconds, so I'll stop there.
Shot clock violation. All right. Yes. What's your favorite activity when practice gets flat?
To end practice.
Go home. I love it. That's your best teaching tool right there. We don't have it today. See you tomorrow. Worst mistake that you've made as a coach or player that's helped you grow?
As a player, punching my college coach and getting kicked off the team.
I remember that story. What's a moment where adversity, this is a hard one, maybe became an advantage for you? Kind of a similar question. Maybe go coach route. I don't like that question.
Well, I will say this. Leaving my 13-year career with Point Guard College PGC was a massive adversity, a big challenge, a very hard decision. But it led to the creation of Savvy Coaching, which I think has been one of the most impactful things that I've been able to do in basketball. So, yeah.
Great answer. All right. Anything you want to go deeper on?
I think if practice starts flat or is flat, you want to use a reset drill or a prime game or teaching or, you know, a consequence, anything to get to a level of energy, to get to your standard. Once you get to your standard, right? And you start going through practice towards the end of practice, once it starts to get flat, I would tend to say, okay, we're done, right? So we strengthen ourselves, we develop better habits, we teach and we learn to get to our standard. But I think just like if players are doing a max lift, when they hit failure, that's their failure for today, right? And then let's see if we can go a little bit longer tomorrow. So I wouldn't end practice 5 minutes in, we'd battle through it. But, you know, once we hit, you know, if we say, oh, I want to practice for 90 minutes and we're, you know, at 78 minutes and it just hit flat, instead of saying, come on, we got to, you know, get our standard up again, I'd be like, no, they've shown me it's probably time to start winding down a little bit.
Yeah. How many conversations have we had with coaches where it's like, oh, we just had to get this stuff in. We just had to grind through it, you know? And it's like, I don't know. Maybe it was counterproductive. That's really good, man. I love that. It's kind of like when you get to, you're doing some work and then you just kind of get to that point where your brain is like, all right, I need a break. Like that's what your team is basically telling you. And we can yell at them and we can do all these things, or we can just like not that I want you to yell at them. Like that's what most coaches would just do, right? Just get frustrated. But yeah, just there's always tomorrow, you know?
There's always tomorrow.
All right. Victory questions, or maybe I'll go through and answer these maybe quickly. All right. Messiest but most effective activity in practice. I'm going to go again, I'll go disadvantage game, but I'll give you a specific one. 3-on-4 keep away, 3 offensive players against 4 defenders. And you play for a shot clock and you can only shoot 9s or 7s. Great way to build pressure principles, but also really good for defense too. Whenever you got to speed the game up. Favorite activity or drill game when practice gets flat? Number 1 would be just measure it. Like a feedback is a measurement tool. Hey, how would we grade our energy level? Thumbs down 1, thumb to the side 2, thumbs up 3, and then identify one thing coming out of that we're all going to be focused on. So instead of just like, hey, we got to get better, we got to have more energy, or we got to clean it up, we're turning the ball over too much. Well, if we're turning the ball over too much, what is it that we're doing? We are I don't know, we're passing when to a player that's not open. Okay, well, let's just eliminate that one thing. Or another thing that we would do out of that is not make a big deal out of it, right? Call our leadership council up. Hey, what's y'all's favorite game that we play in practice? This one. Okay, perfect. Let's go do that right now. And because they're going to actually give you the activity that is going to be best when practice gets flat. Worst mistake I've made that's helped me grow: not being myself when coaching, trying to be someone else, because you realize it's just kind of like we started the podcast with the values. Like, if it's not yours, it's just not going to work. And then moment of adversity that became an advantage. I'll steal your answer and say getting out of coaching was the absolute hardest. I was pulled to do it. And, I never thought I would not coach a team at this point in my life. When I got into coaching, I'm like, I'm going to do this till I die. And I still am coaching, just in a different capacity, and who knows what the future holds.
Yeah. Okay. Follow-up question. What are the odds that you head coach a competitive team again in the next decade?
Oh, decade? Oh, man. I'm going to say less than 50%.
Less than 50%. Okay.
If it was a shorter runway, I would say very small percentage.
If I got 2-1, I would bet that you do in the next decade. If I got 2-1.
Might not be as good of a bet as you think. I don't know. All right. Victory questions. I think I just have three of them here for you. You did a great job going through the Savvy Method. So victory is defining your own victory, but I might use the term win here. Like, we're defining our own win, you know? All right. What's the most underrated win in coaching?
Well, it can't be win because, I mean, Sawi just doesn't sound very good. all right. Sorry. Ask me the question again.
What's the most underrated win in coaching? You can take that however you want it. Win on, off the floor. What's like something that we just don't, we overlook? And
I think it's being around young people. Like, being around young people just keeps you young. It helps you laugh more. It energizes you.
Love it. I'll go ahead and just answer mine right now. Same answer. Whenever I was an assistant coach at my alma mater, which I was later the head coach of, but I got offered a head coaching job and I wasn't even looking for it. Somebody just approached me and said, "Hey, we want you to be the next basketball coach at our school." And I'm like, man, I don't want to leave these kids that I'm coaching. And one of my best friends in coaching, shout out Travis, if you're listening, he said, "Dude, you're going to love the kids everywhere. Like, kids are awesome. Anywhere you coach, like, go take that job and get your career started." One of the best pieces of advice I could get. All right. What's the number one stat you're looking at either during or after a game?
Points per possession.
Can't go wrong. I'm going to go turnover percentage, because at the lower levels, they say of Dean Oliver's four factors, that's the number one metric. But honestly, like, points per possession encompasses all those things. So I just didn't want to give you the same answer. What's one metric that people overvalue?
Rebounds.
Okay. What about undervalue?
Not rebounding, just like raw counting rebounds. We had 20 rebounds that game. Okay, that doesn't tell me anything.
Yeah, well, what if your opponent shot 80% from the field because your defense stunk? Like, there's not a lot of rebounds to get, right? Or what if we shot 80% and we're like, hey, we only got four offensive rebounds. That's pitiful. It's like, well, coach,
what if we shot 10%?
Right. Yeah. What if we shot 10% from the field but had, you know, 20 offensive rebounds? Well, I don't know. Maybe you're probably shooting a better percentage if you got 20 offensive rebounds because second chance points. What is one that people undervalue?
Free throw percentage. Free throw rate, actually. I'll go like free throw rate.
Free throw rate being like how many points came from free throws.
Yeah, or what percent of your
possessions
resulted in shooting free throws or drawing fouls. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think as you go up in level, that becomes more and more important, but maybe that is a advantage for a lower level, when I say lower level, like high school coach, to pay more attention to. I would agree with that one. That's a really good one. Identity questions. What's a non-negotiable of any Savvy program that you would encourage people to implement? Or standard, I guess.
Yeah. Just play fast, and playing fast is everything. It's opportunism. So fast in between your transitions in practice, fast to get started, being impatient to take advantage of opportunities, you know, individual players really being jealous of their time and maximizing reps and moving quickly to the next rep, us running in and out of timeouts, begging for the ball from the referee when it's at a baseline inbounds, like fast, everything fast.
Yeah. I'd say for mine, I would say, touches. Like I mean, my teams don't touch. We don't give enough fives. We're just not, it's just such an indicator of how connected your guys mm-hmm. are, your girls are. Mm-hmm. What's your coaching superpower?
I think it's connection and credibility. I think the ability to walk into a brand new group of people, connect with them within the first 5 minutes, and present in such a way that they're like, oh, he gets it. He's very credible. I trust him.
I would agree with that. Mine would be probably being NATO, not attached to outcomes. Yeah. I think it's been such a important lesson that I've had to learn in my coaching. And once that switch was flipped for me, it's just like my coaching journey became so much easier because I could just coach with conviction. I could commit, I could go all in, and I really didn't care what happened.
I noticed that about you. Like the first time I saw you teach at the Hoosier Gym thing, it was, you were just, your presentation at the coaches clinic, it was in Indiana, everybody, was just so different than everyone's before you. Because everyone before you was attempting to show their stuff in perfection. And nope, that's not the angle that you take. Come back and do that screen again. That's not it. And making fun of the player. Like, nope, you got to be right here. Right. And it was like all five, you know, presentations, whatever it was. And then Mark goes out there and he's like, all right, you can't mess this up. Go. And, you know, and people were like, throwing passes away, and he's like, yeah, good. And, you know, like not rotating right, figure it out, you know, and it was just like, what? And so like, yeah, that was super obvious. And I was like, that was like my first time. I'm like, oh, okay. I vibe with this guy.
That was the first time we met in person.
That was the first time we met.
Yeah. Thank you for introducing yourself. Because yeah, I actually saw you come in the middle of mine. I think you were like, you were presenting the next day or maybe after me or something. And I saw you come in. I knew who you were. And I was like, oh, it's Tyler. Cool. And, you know, you kind of look around. I saw that you were engaged. And I was like, hey, man, if Tyler's enjoying this, I'm doing something right. But I think that's an important lesson in coaching is it's transactional versus transformational. It's like a transactional coach looks at it as like, hey, what can I get out of these players? Right? Like, can they give me wins or can they give me status? But it really should be, what can you give? So whenever I go to a coaching clinic, it's like, man, I don't want to get an applause. I don't want to get a good job. I don't want to get anything out of this. I just want to give as much as I can. So one approach that I do this is my pet peeve in coaching clinics, is a coach shows something and stays with it for like 20 minutes. It's like, dude, we got it. Like, it's great. I can now write that down and take it to my program, move on to the next thing. So I'm always like, all right, even if the players don't get it, do the coaches get it? Because then I can move on. They know it. They can go take it back and bring it to their program, which is the point of a coaching clinic. Last question. What was so you have a very clear identity, right? We have a very like clear way that you want your teams to play and how you're going to coach. What was maybe the most challenging thing for you to embrace as you were developing your identity?
Not having the answer. I think it's probably the most challenging thing to really embrace, like being able to say, I don't know, or like, I don't know, let's check it out. Because early on, I really wanted to be seen as a good coach or a smart coach. You know, I'm thinking back to coaches meetings when I got my shot at Division I, and, you know, I'm in there as the youngest coach in the room, and we're planning. And whenever the head coach would ask me a question, I really pride myself on having an answer and a good, smart answer. And in those coaches meetings, I never said, I'm not sure, let's go test it out. And I wish I had, right? Because I didn't want to be seen as not knowing the answer. You know, I thought there was a right and a wrong answer, and I wanted to get the answer right, so that I could, you know, impress the head coach. So I think that was probably the biggest shift.
What you described is every single Division I coach that's ever existed. Yes. I mean, that is the rat race. That is the just like the unfortunate reality of high stakes coaching. But man, it's such an important lesson of just like, man, we don't have to have all the answers. Like, we don't know until we try this thing. And I guess my answer is very related. I think just when I had my shift is we had gotten to a point. I'll make my coaching journey like really, really, I'm going to make this like the smallest nutshell I can. Man in Motion had a lot of success, started to trend toward modern basketball, won a state title. I was told I was the youngest coach in Louisiana to win a state title at the time. And then I got a quote unquote big job and I went backwards. I was like, man, like this is too, the stakes are too high. Like, I don't think we can do the things that we were doing there. Let me go backwards. And I did that. It was still better than most, like better than where I was. Right. But then as we had some success early and then we didn't change, like for like 3, 4, 5 years, just kind of stayed the same. And I just felt like I'm running on a treadmill. And then I was just like, you know what? Screw this. I know a way that I want to play and I've been scared to do it. I'm just doing it. And it was, we're going to switch everything. We're going to play really fast and I'm going to let all of my dudes shoot the three. And I don't care what happens. If we switch everything and just get punished, we'll figure it out. You know, like we'll, you know, whether we stop switching or we switch better or we get tougher or we get better. I don't care. If we shoot 33s in the game and we lose, I kind of don't care because what we're doing right now ain't getting the results anyway. So, I was scared to do any of that, to be honest, but I didn't want to sprinkle it in either. So we just changed all of those things in one off season. Our coaches were on board. Obviously the players loved it. So they were immediately on board and first game of the season, I'm standing on the sideline watching my team warm up, watching this like inner city team warm up. And I'm like, oh dear, what did I do? Like we might get embarrassed. And, we embarrassed them, man. We scored, I think, like 85 points, won by 30. And who knows if it was the other way around, I probably wouldn't be sitting here. Yeah. But we made the Final Four that year and we were kind of on no one's radar to do that. And it was hard to do it, but the best decision I've made as a coach is just to put the blinders on. At some point in your career, you got to put blinders on and go with it. I would encourage you to embrace the savvy method that Tyler laid out so eloquently at the beginning of the podcast. If you're thinking about it, if you've been on the fence about savvy, now's the time. Put the blinders on, go all in. And if you don't like the results, we'll give you your money back.
Yeah. And I think you'll have more fun along the way. Some more fun doing it with somebody. I mean, we're inviting you to come do it with us and, you know, our 360, 70 other coaches that are doing it. It's more fun to do it with somebody. I was doing this consulting thing alone for a year or two. And I found Mark. I'm like, and it's been way more fun to do it with Mark. We get to record this every week. So I think that's another reason that I'd invite you to come join us at Savvy is it's just more fun to do it with somebody, with a bunch of somebodies. And I think you can get better faster and maybe develop some good relationships along the way.
Well said. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We will see you next time. Don't forget to stay savvy.
Stay savvy.